Good day. Today is Friday, 3rd October 2025, and over the course of this week, we have had two contrasting meetings taking place in different parts of Europe. One is the meeting that has been taking place in Copenhagen, which has brought together various European countries to talk about the situation in Ukraine and in the conflict in Ukraine. And the other is the completely different, entirely different Valdai meeting, which yesterday was addressed by the Russian President Vladimir Putin. Let me start with the first of these meetings, the one in Copenhagen. And can I say that watching and listening the various European leaders address that meeting, and by the way, I would add that the Ukrainian president, Vladimir Zelensky, was also there, and he also spoke extensively at this meeting in his usual way. Well, watching and listening to these European leaders, particularly Frederiksen, the Danish prime minister, I have to say that it brought very much to mind the meeting that took place in February 2022 at the Munich Security Conference. I'm not saying that the same people participated. That would not be true. Apart from Emmanuel Macron, I think that there's been an almost complete clear out of the European and, by the way, American leaders who participated in the conference in Munich in February 2022, though, of course, Ursula von der Leyen was there. But even though the cast of characters in Copenhagen is different, it was nonetheless striking to compare the Copenhagen meeting with the one that took place back in 2022, in February 2022 in Munich. Now, I have discussed the Munich Security Conference in many programmes, both on this channel and on the Duran and in other places. That conference, the Munich Security Conference, took place shortly before the start of the special military operation. I remember watching the European leaders and the American leaders. The Americans were, of course, also present at the Munich Security Conference. I remember watching them at the time. Up to that point, I had thought it most unlikely that a military conflict would indeed begin in Europe. I thought that sense would prevail, that there would be diplomatic contacts, and that a diplomatic solution to the rising tensions would be found. But watching that meeting of European leaders, and I should say Western leaders, it was the first moment when it started to sink in with me that a major conflict was indeed coming. Because I remember the extraordinary, dizzy sense of euphoria at that meeting, the way speaker after speaker, Boris Johnson, Annalena Baerbock, Kamala Harris, Ursula von der Leyen, as I now remember, Emmanuel Macron, all spoke. And it seemed to me that they not only were expecting a conflict in Europe, but they were looking forward with euphoric anticipation to it. They seem to be, as I've discussed in many places, in a state of virtual intoxication. And since then, and I accept that this is my view, but since then it's become clear to me that they'd already worked out in advance their enormous sanctions package, the biggest, most powerful sanctions package that has ever been put together against any one country, a sanctions package which was clearly intended to provoke a major financial crash in Russia, and which they undoubtedly anticipate would create a financial crash in Russia, leading to the collapse of the Russian economy. Anyway, it was clear to me that they'd already worked it all out in advance. They were looking forward to doing this. It was universally assumed, as the French finance minister at the time said, that this financial crash caused by the European sanctions would cause the ruble to collapse and the financial system in Russia to collapse, and that this would indeed lead rapidly to collapse of the Russian economy, which was expected to fall back to 1990s levels. I remember people saying that at the time. And it was taken for granted that this would in turn lead to the fall of the Russian government, to a political crisis, and the loss of power, resignation or ousting of Russian President Vladimir Putin. So that is what I believe all of those leaders were anticipating, and as I further believe, looking forward to when they all came together in Munich in February 2022. And as I said, the atmosphere was one of delirious enthusiasm and, well, frankly, euphoria. Now, the meeting in Copenhagen is the mirror image of that meeting in Munich in February 2022. Because this time there is no euphoria, there is anger, extraordinary levels of anger, and where there is anger, one can usually see fear. And that was my overwhelming impression of this meeting. There was a lot of talk of war, of Europe being on the brink of war, or of being actually at war. The Danish Prime Minister, Mrs. Frederiksen, spoke, I thought, in an extraordinary way. She spoke about the permanent, perpetual threat from Russia, the Russian army, the Russian empire of the past, the Red Army and its tanks rolling into European cities, that this had been supposedly the long-term history of relations between Europe and Russia, an impression of a Russia that is permanently and continuously aggressive, and a reframing of European history of the last presumably 200 years on that basis. Something which, given the realities of that history, what actually happened during the two world wars and indeed the Napoleonic wars that preceded it, and you could even argue the Crimean War, seemed to me an extraordinary misrepresentation of modern European history. Others also spoke in that same way. They spoke about how Ukraine was the last line of defence. I think it was one of the Polish leaders, either Prime Minister Tusk or Foreign Minister Sikorski, who spoke about how a defeat of Ukraine in the ongoing conflict would be a defeat of Europe. An extraordinary and actually very insightful and very interesting comment, an interesting admission, if you like, of the way in which European leaders have now framed this conflict to themselves. But anyway, there was an extraordinary procession of comments of this kind, all spoken in exaggerated terms, extraordinary anger and fury and statements about Russia and indeed its president, which I'm not going to discuss and explore further. And of course, Zelensky himself, who was also there, made inevitably his own contribution. He demanded more sanctions, more actions against the Russians. He always demands more action against the Russians. He demands extreme measures. He also speaks of Europe being in effect in this titanic struggle with the Russians, Ukrainians, again, the last line of defence, if you like, before the Russian tide, which will presumably continue to surge westwards, sweeping all before it if Ukraine itself does not hold. Obviously, the actual specific words of the various leaders who participated in this meeting in Copenhagen were, well, they were different in the detail. But I think if we're talking about the broad brush of what was said at this meeting, I don't think I can be faulted for my overall description of it. I have to say that I was staggered, despite all that we have heard and seen over the last 3.5 years. I perhaps ought to be used by now to this extraordinary outburst of anger and fury. But there it is. The extraordinary fierceness of the language, I have to say, really took my breath away. And of course, behind it all of these recent events that we've been hearing so much about, the decoy drones, the Russian decoy drones, which have crossed the Ukrainian border and reached Poland and entered Polish airspace. As I've said already, there is no doubt at all that these were Russian drones. Now, there's been many theories and speculations as to how that happened, whether the Russians were responsible, whether the Ukrainians might have been responsible. Let me repeat again, I don't know. And a proper investigation, which the Russians, by the way, have in effect offered, is the way to find out. But nobody seems to be interested in carrying out that investigation. There were some reports that a house in a Polish village was damaged by one of these drones. Only I've seen reports that it was not the case at all, that the house was actually damaged by an air-to-air missile launched by a fighter jet, a NATO fighter jet, seeking unsuccessfully to shoot down these drones, which instead did damage to this house. But anyway, put all that aside, to me, and I repeat this, this looks like a minor incident. These drones were unarmed. The idea that they were intended to test NATO air defences seems to me far-fetched in the extreme. And I know many people say that this was some kind of test by the Russians, some kind of threat by the Russians. But how do you conduct a test or make a threat using unarmed decoy drones? It seems to me that, again, people are piling up far too much of this, well, far-fetched and extravagant speculation based on a minor incident. And, well, we had the incident of the MiG-31 fighter jets flying from Karelia to Kaliningrad. Maybe they did stray outside the very narrow boundary of the flight line that they're supposed to follow. And maybe they did fly over this uninhabited rock in the Baltic Sea that is part of Estonia. A protest from Estonia would be enough to cover this incident. I understand that incidents like this happen and happen fairly regularly. There are incursions of aircraft on a fairly regular basis into the airspace of various countries, and it's not usually inflated into the kind of incident that this has been. And then we've had the mysterious drones that have been flying over airports in Denmark, and I believe elsewhere in Scandinavia, though it is Denmark, that people seem to be talking about. And of course, President Zelensky said a couple of days ago that these drones were almost certainly being launched by tankers, oil tankers, crossing the Baltic Sea, carrying Russian oil, part of the so-called shadow fleet, the Russian shadow fleet. And that seemed to me a wild claim. But of course, as night follows day, this claim of President Zelensky's was then seized upon by the French authorities. They did indeed stop and detain one of these shadow fleet tankers, one that operates under the flag of Benin. And the captain, who turned out to be Chinese, by the way, a Chinese citizen, was arrested and there was a search done. And President Macron made all kinds of statements about this, which we'll come to shortly. But as far as I'm aware, nothing appears to have been found. Nothing untoward appears to have been found on this tanker. And I understand that it has been released by the French authorities and it is sailing towards the Mediterranean and is expected before long to reach the Mediterranean and then pass through the Mediterranean and travel through the Suez Canal on its way, presumably to the Far East, to China maybe, with its cargo of Russian crude oil. I read articles of an extraordinary article, for example, in the Daily Telegraph talking about this incident and about this particular tanker and how this tanker had been monitored and had been watched and had turned up in all kinds of places from which it might have launched these drones. But squirreled into this article was the word alleged. Alleged Russian drones that had flown over the airport in Denmark. And of course, the word alleged really says it all, because when you use a word like that, you are in effect admitting that you don't actually know. You don't know whether those drones were Russian, whether the Russian authorities had anything to do with it. As I've said myself, I personally have experienced flight delays over, I believe it was Heathrow Airport, because there was drone sightings near the airport, but nobody at that time was suggesting that the drones in question were Russian. So anyway, there it is, that particular incident, talked up, exaggerated in all kinds of remarkable ways, but there it is. And then there is the Yantar, a Russian spy ship. And by the way, I am going to accept the view that it is probably a Russian spy ship. It belongs to the GUGI, I'm proud to pronounce it, organization, which is technically a part of the Russian Navy, but is widely believed to be a branch or supervised in some way by Russian military intelligence. And I don't dispute this at all. And it is a very modern ship. And you can see pictures of it. And it appears to be festooned with radars and other electronic devices. And it has indeed been passing through the seas of Northwest Europe, and no doubt it is conducting intelligence whilst it is doing so. It's been suggested that it is looking at underwater cables, but of course, again, we don't know, and it is not doing anything so far that we're aware of with respect to those underwater cables. Now, Russian spy ships have existed throughout the Cold War. I remember many films about Soviet trawlers that had been converted into spy ships during the Cold War by the Soviet Navy. And in fact, it was a standard part of the Cold War that these trawlers or spy ships operated. And of course, the NATO countries also have their own means of surveillance, and this happens regularly. The two sides constantly monitor and spy on each other. And as far as I can see, this is what Yantar is probably doing. And of course, it is probably what we in the West are also doing as well. In fact, I have absolutely no doubt that we are. If you go to the Russian internet, you will see that they talk repeatedly about overflights of the Black Sea, for example, by Western NATO surveillance aircraft and drones, and how these appear to be monitoring and examining Russian military facilities, often, so the Russians say, in advance of Ukrainian drone and missile strikes on those same Russian facilities. So again, it doesn't seem to me that there is anything particularly unusual about the Yantar. There is an article today in The Economist which basically claims that all of these incidents taken together represent some kind of plausibly deniable action being taken by the Russian authorities. I come back and say what I have said previously, that whilst that may be true, each of these incidents in themselves is so negligible as to amount to almost a zero, and any number multiplied by zero equals zero. So anyway, whatever has been happening, it doesn't justify the anger and frustration that we saw on display in Copenhagen, not remotely. And President Macron has been talking about seizing ships of the so-called shadow fleet, the Russian shadow fleet, on the high seas, detaining them for periods of time, all supposedly with the objective of disrupting Russia's oil trade. This is, of course, entirely illegal, just to say. There's no justification for simply seizing ships on the high seas without any valid or legal cause, simply because they are perfectly legally transporting oil from one country to another country, just saying. And of course, Macron doesn't really provide any legal justification for such a move. And again, I find this really, in and of itself, quite extraordinary, just to say. So anyway, there it is. We have talk about seizing ships on the high seas. We have comments about war, about the Russian Empire, the Red Army crossing borders and doing all of those things. Extraordinary perspectives of history and extreme displays of anger on the part of the European leaders. Now, when there is anger of this kind, there is usually fear. And this has been something that I think is widely understood by most people, that anger and fear usually go, or very often go together. And this is where I bring back the Munich Security Conference of February 2022. Because at the time of the Munich Security Conference, there was euphoria because there was an overwhelming conviction that the sanctions that were being prepared would be effective. And I don't think anybody then expected that the Russian economy would adapt rapidly and would sail on. By contrast, now there is anger and fear because I think over the last couple of weeks, there's gradually a growing sense of understanding amongst the Europeans that the war that is being fought in Ukraine is being lost. And I suspect that this is what underpins all the fear and anger that we have seen. Now, notice that despite all kinds of claims about action that would be taken, nothing positive by way of action was announced at this meeting in Copenhagen. All of the European leaders came together. They spoke furiously and angrily in the way that I have described. But all that fire and thunder produced nothing positive in the way of action. We are promised that something further will come at the meeting of the European Council, which is due at the end of October, and no doubt something will. It seems that there was discussions again about this loan, the 140 billion euro loan that Friedrich Merz and Ursula von der Leyen, who apparently don't like each other and are in rivalry with one another, are going to float and provide to Ukraine, which is going to be secured against the frozen Russian assets. But it seems that some countries, France, Belgium, Luxembourg, have expressed doubts and disagreements about this idea. I wonder whether Macron's extraordinary rhetoric about seizing ships on the high seas isn't partly intended to make up for the fact that he has doubts and fears about seizing Russian assets and wants to say something which will reassure the other European leaders that he remains fully on side with them. Just say. But anyway, for the moment, there didn't seem to be very much of anything actually come out of that meeting in Copenhagen. And notice again that about the coalition of the willing that we've been hearing so much about the deployment of European forces to Ukraine, about security guarantees for Ukraine, about American backstops to European forces entering Ukraine. All that, all discussion of that appears to have melted away. I didn't hear anything about this at this meeting in Copenhagen. Now, I have to say, listening to this meeting, it did bring back a poem by an American Quaker abolitionist poet of the 19th century, which has been converted into a well-known Anglican hymn. Well, I believe it's not just an Anglican, which in one of its last words refers to the small, still voice of calm. And it did seem to me that that was the one thing that was mostly missing from this meeting. There was no small, still voice of calm. There was strong pushback from one European leader, and that was Viktor Orban of Hungary. Now, as I understand it, Orban is under intense pressure within Hungary itself. Next year, there are parliamentary elections. He faces, for the first time in many years, a serious challenge. And of course, Hungary itself has been affected by the worldwide rise in prices. People in Hungary are under pressure. So one can't say with absolute certainty that Prime Minister Orban is going to be re-elected at this election, which is coming in 2026, though for the record, I believe he will be. Anyway, regardless of that, I am going to suggest that this meeting in Copenhagen was, in terms of international politics, Prime Minister Orban's finest hour. I have never known him to exercise such self-possession and clarity, even as madness and rage is there all around him. He made comments about how Hungary is not at war with Russia. The European Union is not at war with Russia. How he intends to defend Hungarian national interests, and that these remain his obligation and his priority. He's issued warnings about this extraordinary war talk that came out of this meeting in Copenhagen. And again, he seemed to me that one voice of sanity and reason that had the courage to speak out over the course of this meeting. It was, again, striking to see the difference in body language between Orban, who seemed calm and confident in what he was saying, and the agitated behaviour of some of the other European leaders, including Prime Minister Donald Tusk of Poland, who I suspect is increasingly out of tune with public opinion in Poland, and who now has to contend with a Polish president, Mr. Nawrocki, who does seem to take a different and much more sober view of events than Prime Minister Tusk does. But anyway, Tusk also talked about this Manichaean struggle that is taking place between Russia and Europe. And pointedly, he spoke about Hungary having to choose sides. And of course, President Zelensky, in his comments, demanding a total embargo in Europe and total rejection of Russian energy supplies, oil and gas supplies. He, of course, mentioned the Hungarians also. Well, Orban remained calm in the face of all of that. And as I said, as far as I'm concerned, this was his finest hour. I would say this, I don't agree with Orban on everything, not by any means. But he seemed to me to be the only leader at this meeting in Copenhagen who, as I said, retained a sense of proportion and a sense of balance and had the courage to say things that no one else, though I suspect some of the others privately think as he does, but things that no one else at this meeting had the courage to say. Now, there is one very important difference between this meeting in Copenhagen and the Munich Security Conference of February 2022. And that is that, of course, at the Munich Security Conference in February 2022, the Americans, the Biden administration, was there in force. Kamala Harris, Victoria Nuland, various others. Whereas at this meeting in Copenhagen, so far as I could see, the Americans were not present. And that is, of course, a decisive difference, because for all the fire and thunder, for all the talk about war, for all the talk about decisive action being taken against the Russians by the Europeans, part of the anger and frustration is that the Europeans know that without the Americans, they are nothing. They have no ability to do anything that will embarrass or inconvenience, even inconvenience, the Russians in any significant way. To the extent that the Europeans have been able to do things, they have already done them. In the many sanctions packages they have previously brought into effect. From this point on, it all depends entirely on what the Americans can or will do. Now, over the course of the last week, I have been increasingly concerned about what appeared to me to be the drift of American policy towards a more confrontational direction towards Russia. We had the discussions about Tomahawk missile supplies to Ukraine, discussions about possible supply of the Barracuda missile to Ukraine. We've had President Trump's apparent authorization to provide further intelligence to Ukraine to enable the Ukrainians to conduct deep strikes inside Russia. We've had comments by General Kellogg, and we've had comments by the Vice President, J.D. Vance. Well, let me begin by saying that I've now had a further opportunity to listen carefully to what J.D. Vance actually said. And I think that when listened to carefully, it came across to me that perhaps J.D. Vance was being rather less categorical than appeared to be the case. He was saying that the Russians needed to come to their senses and to negotiate, which of course is in line with what President Trump and other officials of the administration had been saying. But on the key issue of Tomahawk cruise missile deliveries, actually, when you unpack his words carefully, he didn't say that he supported that. He didn't say that he opposed it. He said that it is under discussion and that it is for the president ultimately to decide. Well, that is an interesting comment from Vance, because we've now had statements about this incredibly bad idea, by the way, from Reuters, which casts doubt on whether the Tomahawk missiles will indeed ever be supplied to Ukraine. US Tomahawk missile shipments to Ukraine, unlikely sources say. The Trump administration's desire to send long-range Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine may not be viable because current inventories are committed to the US Navy and other US uses, a US official and three sources said. Always these anonymous officials and sources. And then we're told that we're then told that a US official and sources familiar with Tomahawk missile training and supplies questioned the feasibility of providing the cruise missiles. The US official stressed that there was no shortage of the workhorse weapon, which is often used by the military for land attack missiles, suggesting other shorter distance options could be supplied to Ukraine. The official said the US may look into allowing European allies to buy other longer range weapons and supply them to Ukraine, but Tomahawks were unlikely. And there's no explanation as to quite why, the point is, the article then goes on to say that the Tomahawk missile has been in production since the mid-1980s. In recent years, production has ranged from 55 to 90 per year. According to Pentagon budget data, the United States plans to buy 57 missiles in 2026. Now, this is far less, by the way, than I had believed. I said in one of my recent videos that I understood that production of Tomahawk missiles by the United States was of the same order of magnitude as production of Patriot missile interceptors. This is clearly not the case. I assumed that the United States was producing around 500 Tomahawk missiles a year, which is roughly the number of Patriot missile interceptors it produces each year. It turns out that it is producing far less than this, between 55 and 90 per year. And this against an inventory of these missiles that numbers around 4,000. And as this article in the in Reuters says, almost the entire Tomahawk missile arsenal is committed to use by the American military. First and foremost, the Navy. And of course, it is indeed the case that Tomahawk cruise missiles are an essential part of the US Navy's armory. They are mostly launched, or so I understand it, by submarines and by Aegis-class destroyers. And of course, those ships and those missiles are presumably mostly earmarked for a possible conflict with China. Now, of course, there are other reasons why deliveries of Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine might not be a viable option. It's not just that these missiles are in relatively short supply, despite the assurance in this Reuters article that they are not, but also that there is no existing satisfactory ground-launched system to launch them from within the territory of Ukraine. The Typhon system barely exists. There are only two operational versions of this system. The United States is apparently only now entering into production of these systems, and it is unlikely that they will be available in quantity for several years. So the Typhon really is not an option, and it is an enormous, expensive, bulky, complex system that would be extremely difficult to maintain in the field in Ukraine, and which would be an easy target for the Russians. So that is one theoretical option for ground-launched Tomahawk missiles from Ukraine, but hardly a viable one. There are suggestions, I've received suggestions, that a simpler method based upon maybe the Harpoon onshore system could be developed, but there is no word that this system even exists or is being planned, and in any event, it would probably also take some time before it could be put into production, and it would still probably provide launch facilities for insufficient Tomahawk missiles for these missiles to be used effectively. So there are problems of viability, as we will see. As I've already discussed in many programs, the likelihood also is that if they were ever deployed in battle, the Russian air defense system would be able to cope with them. As we will see shortly, that is what President Putin of Russia believes. So the talk about the Tomahawks might not be very real. It's been suggested by some people, by Zelensky. The idea for it has been enthusiastically taken up by General Kellogg, but it seems to be running into opposition within the United States. I suspect the Pentagon and the US Navy are opposed to this idea. I don't think J.D. Vance's comments necessarily mean that he supports this idea. And the Reuters article rather suggests that a decision has been made against supplying it. The alternative missile that we've been hearing so much about, the Barracuda, as I discussed also in my program yesterday, is a new untested missile, which, as far as I am aware, is not yet in serial production. So I can't really see that it can be brought into service anytime soon by the United States or supplied in large quantities to Ukraine. So anyway, it's possible that the belligerent language we have been hearing from the United States over the last couple of days or week or so actually, in the end, means less than it seems. I say that, I don't know that. Of course, it could be that the president, very, very angry because President Putin is not moving forward decisively to freeze the conflict in the way that the president wants. It may be that the president is indeed angry and that he's now searching for some way to gain leverage over the Russians. That's the theory that I have run with over the last couple of days. But thinking about matters further and looking at the logistical and other issues, I wonder really whether this can actually be so. Whether what we're seeing is another lobbying effort by some people in the United States, General Kellogg, for example, which has gained a certain amount of media attention, but that in reality, American policy remains what the president has previously indicated, which is disengagement. Not total disengagement. The United States continues to provide intelligence. The United States continues to provide other assistance. It continues to provide a flow of weapons, though these are weapons that the Europeans are expected to pay for, but that the United States perhaps is not as committed to support for Ukraine as it was this time last year when the Biden administration was still in office. Not complete disengagement, but a reduction of engagement significantly. And I come back to my point that the major things, escalatory steps that the Western, the European powers were seeking from the beginning of August, security guarantees for Ukraine, backstops for European peacekeepers, those kind of things, those things that they were demanding from the United States, further sanctions against Russia, American tariffs against countries that bought Russian oil, none of that has appeared. And to repeat again, there was no American official, senior American official, apparently participating in this meeting in Copenhagen. So it could be that behind some of the warlike rhetoric that has been coming from the United States as well, which it should be said, however, is nowhere near as strong as the rhetoric that we have been hearing from the Europeans at this meeting in Copenhagen. It could be that what we are actually continuing to see is that process of disengagement that President Trump basically indicated a short time ago. Now, if that is correct, then that might explain the moderation of the Russian reaction. Because the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has said that he doesn't believe that the United States will, in fact, supply Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has said that the latest announcement by the United States that President Trump is allowing Ukraine to obtain more intelligence, US intelligence, for deep strikes against Russia, it doesn't actually change anything of substance because the Ukrainians have never had any difficulty obtaining that intelligence from the Americans whenever they have wanted to. So that this isn't really, it doesn't really represent any shift. I wonder, I do wonder whether perhaps quietly, the Russians have been told by someone in the United States, perhaps US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, over the course of his recent meeting with Lavrov in New York, don't take some of what you're going to hear over the next week or so especially seriously. We have to manage the Europeans and we have to manage the Ukrainians. You may hear things about Tomahawk missiles and Barracuda missiles and changes to intelligence and all of that. But really, in practice, it is going to change nothing. Just saying. Now, of course, you could argue that the Russians are again being naive, that the Russians maybe are underestimating or are being tricked by the Trump administration. The Trump administration has tricked others in recent weeks and months, as I've discussed and we've discussed extensively in previous programs. But I do think that there is a difference, and that is that these reassurances, if assuming that they have been given, must ultimately correspond to some extent with the truth. Because I have discussed in programs, and I've received a deluge of information from all sorts of people about the impracticalities of supplying Tomahawk cruise missiles to Ukraine. The Barracuda missile, as I've said, does not even in production numbers, properly speaking, exist. And the point about intelligence being provided to Ukraine by the United States to enable deep strikes with inside Russia. Well, what Peskov is saying, that the Americans have already, to all intents and purposes, been providing it, well, that basically does look to be true. Now, if this is correct, then it probably ties in to the rage and anger that we saw in Copenhagen, because the Americans are not there. Perhaps they're not providing the support that the Europeans are looking for and expected. And without the Americans, the Europeans know that this game is lost. Now, I have said in programs that I've been making for some time that I gained the impression around mid-year, around July, that the Ukrainians, sometime around July, finally realized that the war was lost, that unless some dramatic change took place, some major political crisis in Moscow, or a fundamental shift of policy in the United States, leading to direct intervention by the United States in the conflict in Ukraine, or something of that kind, that sooner or later, Ukraine was going to lose the war. I wonder whether the reason for this anger that we have seen in Copenhagen could be that the Europeans have finally understood the same thing. That when Donald Tusk, I think it was him, says that a defeat for Ukraine is a defeat for Europe, the Europeans have suddenly realized that they are now looking at precisely that defeat. They're staring at that defeat in the face. Anyway, there was that other meeting, the one that took place in Russia, the Valdai meeting. And here, the atmosphere could not have been more different. Now, President Putin gave a long, somewhat philosophical speech, as he likes to do from time to time, about the international situation. He coined a new phrase. I've actually, curiously enough, myself received some complaints from various people that the word multipolar isn't really a very attractive word, and it doesn't really explain the new global system that is emerging. Well, President Putin coined a new one. He, instead of multipolar, has started using the word polycentric. And perhaps that is a more attractive phrase. And he talked about the new polycentric system that is now replacing the unipolar system that we are leaving behind us. He talked about how much more democratic this polycentric system is going to be, how the countries with completely different systems of organization, state organization and governance, can nonetheless come together without finger pointing and without hierarchies based on somebody's values, and they can all work together and look for solutions together to their various problems. And he talked extensively about how this polycentric system that is emerging requires a return to what he called classical diplomacy. And a lot of his speech was centered around this. But in some respects, most of the speech, most interesting things that he had to say were about the conflict with the West, about the conflict with the Europeans and the United States, and about the situation, the military situation in Ukraine. And I'm going to say that the thing that struck me about Putin over the course of this meeting is that, again, he came across as relaxed, confident, witty at times. He was constantly making jokes and engaging in wordplay, not always easy for people in the West to understand. So when, for example, he talked about Emmanuel Macron as his good friend, he doesn't really mean that Macron is indeed a good friend. When he spoke about former British Prime Minister Blair as being an experienced politician, one whom Putin himself has met and stayed at his home in, and how they once drank coffee together in pyjamas, and how good that coffee was. He was actually damning with faint praise, to use an English expression. Anyway, there was an awful lot of that in this speech and in these comments. There was also a long quote from Pushkin, one of Pushkin's poems from the 1830s about Russia and the Europe, a poem about the Battle of Borodino, where the Russian army fought Napoleon's army outside Moscow during the campaign of 1812, very famous event in Russian history. Anyway, there was an awful lot of that, but the overall impression I got is of a very self-confident political leader, one who senses that both in terms of international affairs, the general changes in the international system, and in terms of the conflict in Ukraine, and in terms of domestic developments within Russia, things are increasingly going in his favour. Where you had anger and perhaps fear in Copenhagen, in this speech of Putin's and over the course of the question and answer session, you got a sense of lightness and humour and calm and even fun. Now, Larry Johnson at Sonar 2021, pushing back against some of the claims that have been made about Putin facing potential political challenges from Russian hardliners, made the point that the Putin that was on display at the Valdai meeting did not look like a leader who is facing challenges in that kind of way. And I have to say, I agree with him. I have never taken seriously claims that Putin is at any conceivable risk of any kind of palace coup or of being ousted from power or anything of that kind. Anyway, about the military situation in Ukraine, he was completely confident. He spoke about the Russians advancing in every part of the combat line. He joked about Russia, the comment about Russia being a paper tiger. He said, well, you know, this paper tiger is not only defeating Ukraine, but is defeating a Ukraine that has been massively armed, equipped, supplied by NATO. And if Russia is a paper tiger, in spite of that, what does that make NATO? Incredibly, some of the commentary in the British media has interpreted this comment of Putin's as somehow threatening. Again, he's making a joke, but of course a joke with a point, which is that, of course, in reality, Russia is not a paper tiger at all. He did show one important flash of anger when he spoke about Finland and Sweden's decision to join NATO. He clearly feels deeply betrayed, especially by the Finns, over this, a view that many Russians, by the way, share. He said that all the relations between Finland and Russia appear to have been sorted out after the Second World War. Finland and Russia had, for much of the post-Second World War period, excellent relations. On what grounds, therefore, has Finland decided to join NATO? And he ridiculed claims that the Finns are not going to host American nuclear weapons. He said that he knows exactly how things in NATO work and that he doesn't believe any assurances of that kind given by the Finns. It was the only real moment of anger that Putin expressed over the entire course of the Valdai meeting. And he also spoke at length about his time as director of the FSB, Russia's counterintelligence service, and his astonishment at the time when he discovered the extent of Western support for the insurgencies, the various insurgencies in Chechnya and in the Northern Caucasus in the 1990s and 2000s. And that it was this which brought home to him the extent to which the Europeans and the Americans remained still hostile to Russia, and that it was not simply ideology that underpinned the Cold War, but also a generalized hostility towards Russia, and that for that reason, the explosion of anger against Russia and the actions that the Europeans took against Russia following the start of the special military operation did not surprise him. I should say that I believe that this experience, this realization about what was really happening in the Caucasus, he speaks about how helicopters, I presume American helicopters, were transferring fighters, insurgent fighters, from one place to another. And one would love to know the details of this and how it was done. But anyway, I suspect that this has been a decisive event in forming Putin's understanding of relations with the West. Putin is often assumed by many people to be naive about the West, but this experience strongly suggests otherwise. Anyway, Putin spoke about all of that, but he did also speak about other things. And as I said, he was confident about the military situation. He still held out some possibilities of moving forward with the Americans to normalize relations. But I got the strong experience listening to him that he doesn't expect that this will end the conflict in Ukraine. He is looking beyond it. He made some very interesting points about strategic weapons, the Strategic Arms Treaty. He clearly doesn't believe that it will be extended in February. The START Treaty will be extended in February. He spoke about Russia's own ability to develop nuclear weapons and its nuclear arsenal, which was putting Russia in a secure position, according to him. He hinted at new weapons coming, and he also made clear that if the United States continues to insist that China be included in future negotiations about limits on strategic weapons, then Russia will insist that Britain and France be included also. And that is something which I can say in advance, the British and French will not be happy about, would not be happy about at all, and would be certain to vigorously oppose and resist. Anyway, I'm not going to discuss this in much more detail. Putin said many other things. I mean, he said that Russia poses no threat to the West, poses no threat to Europe. He said that this is an absurd idea. He ridiculed the claims about the Russian drones. He spoke about the seizure of the tanker, the Russian oil tanker, by the French as piracy, and said that this would be something that if the Europeans proceeded with would be escalatory. He made it clear that if the Europeans and the Americans do start conducting deep strikes inside Russia, that the Russians will respond, but he was careful not to say in what way. And he said specifically that if he did, that would be seen as aggressive and would escalate the situation, the tension, even further. And he didn't want to do that. My overall sense is of a leader calm and confident and going about his business. One gets always, continuously, people who say that Putin is complacent, that Putin underestimates the intensity and hostility towards him and towards Russia of the West, that Putin ought to take further steps to accelerate and intensify the special military operation, because failing to do so might result in all sorts of bad or worse things happening. My own sense is that Putin himself has no illusions, but believes that he has the situation fully under control, and who is also increasingly looking forward to further developments in the Russian economy, which is another matter completely separate, which I'm going to discuss in future programs. Anyway, that was my overall sense. As to the Tomahawk missiles, he said that these are outdated missiles. They're old, they're still potent, and they're still powerful, but he is confident that if they are ever supplied to Ukraine, Ukraine will find that they are not a game changer and that Russia's air defense system will rapidly get on top of them. And about that, I am sure he's right. And in a particularly interesting set of comments, he discussed Ukrainian casualties. He said that Ukraine is losing more men each month than it can replace, and that this is the fundamental problem that the Ukrainians are facing. They can be supplied with drones and missiles and tanks and Tomahawk missiles and other things, but ultimately they cannot win the war because their losses are too high and that those losses simply cannot be replaced. So, confidence on Putin's part and on Russian's part. And as I said, a press conference, or rather, well, not a press conference, but a Q&A and a speech conducted with calm and humour and fear and anger on the other side in Copenhagen. As I have said many times, I am not a betting man, but I know where I would put my money if I was obliged to make a choice. Anyway, this leaves little time to discuss military developments, and I will do so very briefly. But the war in Ukraine, of course, itself continues to go on. And over the course of the last 24 hours, there has been another massive Russian drone, combined drone and missile strike across Ukraine. And there's been some rather plaintive comments, which I've seen on the Ukrainian side of the internet. It's been pointed out that some months ago, there was a lot of talk in Ukraine about a new type of interceptor drone that Ukraine was going to create, which was going to shoot down the Geran drones in the sky. And there's questions being asked about what has happened to them, because they don't seem to be having much effect. And Mariana Bezuglaya, the dissident Ukrainian MP, has come out and said, well, actually, these drones don't really exist. They're a concept that nobody has ever translated into real production. And that the reality is that the entire system of defending against Russian drones and the whole air defense system in Ukraine is disorganized and chaotic, and that there really isn't any plan or idea about what to do. Well, that's Bezuglaya, and of course others might dispute that, but anyway, that is what she said. I have found her overall, I ought to say, a reliable reporter of these kind of matters. Anyway, even as the Russians continue to conduct massive drone and missile strikes, and I will have to discuss this latest attack in more detail in my programme tomorrow, because as of now, I'm not entirely sure what targets it was exactly that the Russians were attacking. It does seem to have focused mostly on northeastern Ukraine and to have included Kiev, just saying. But anyway, the actual fighting on the front lines continues, and well, perhaps the most dramatic information continues to come from the Zaporozhye and Dnipropetrovsk regions. The Russian advance there continues remorselessly. There is now apparently fighting either inside or immediately outside the two villages of Poltavka and Uspenivka, which are one of the main Ukrainian barriers, or at least the last big Ukrainian barrier, actually, before the main road, the main supply road leading from the north to the Ukrainian city of Guliapolye in Zaporozhye region, which is, of course, one of the three remaining large population centers in Zaporozhye region, still under Ukrainian control. The other two are Orekhov and, of course, the city of Zaporozhye itself. Anyway, the Russians are now attacking these two villages, and there's talk that they're also advancing further north and that they're approaching the road from another direction, this main supply road from another direction as well. But as I said, this is an interesting battle, but I will discuss it in more detail in the next program. And Rydovka, the Russian newspaper based in Smolensk, gave a detailed account of what it says is the fighting northeast of Pokrovsk in the area of the Russian breakthrough. In August, it said that there had been three attempts by the Ukrainians to counterattack in this area since late August. All of three of these attempts have been unsuccessful, that there is a Ukrainian force that is cut off in at least part of the village of Nikaronovka, that the Russians are in all other respects advancing, but Rydovka said that it is not impossible that despite the failure of the three other Ukrainian counterattacks, the Ukrainians might decide to attack in this area again. The actually very interesting blog, Events in Ukraine, has a description, an interesting account, drawn from reports by the BBC, the Ukrainian language part of the BBC, about the assault regiments that apparently the Ukrainian commander in chief, military commander in chief, General Sirski, has created. And from the way they are described by this article, they seem to be almost a kind of Praetorian guard to protect Sirski himself, maybe, and conceivably Zelensky also. And they are used by Zelensky to conduct attacks in various places. And the article goes into detail about Sirski's obsession with offensives and attacks, despite the enormous cost in casualties and losses that this causes to the Ukrainian military, and the disagreement between Sirski and his predecessor Zaluzhny about this strategy, with Zaluzhny thinking that constant attacks are the kind that Sirski adopts, all that they ultimately do is drain the Ukrainian military of manpower and resources and lead to a humanitarian tragedy on top of that. That may very well be true, by the way. Anyway, it seems to me, going back to this article in Events in Ukraine and the BBC articles upon which it is based, that this again explains this incredibly aggressive strategy that Sirski is following in this area of the Russian breakthrough, northeast of Pokrovsk, counterattack after counterattack to try to push the Russians back. None of these counterattacks are successful. The losses mount, the Russians gradually consolidate, and in the meantime, a little further to the south, Pokrovsk itself, step by step, is being lost. And The accounts of these battles by Redovka and the analysis in this blog, in this blog piece, Events in Ukraine, appear to dovetail with each other. But all of these things I'm going to discuss in more detail in future programs. This is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.